Good day and welcome to this podcast hosted by the African Center for Biodiversity. My name is Miriam Myatt and I'm the director of the African Center for Biodiversity. This podcast focuses on a reflection of a decade-long litigation in the South African courts when ACB challenged GMO decision-making concerning the approval of commercial growing of a particular genetically modified maize said to be drought-tolerant. This litigation was supported by Professor Jack Heinemann, Dr. Angelica Hilbeck, and Dr. Eva Sininapsinji, all of whom are with us today. Recently, we celebrated the victories in the Supreme Court of Appeal, and more recently, the Constitutional Court, which essentially came down to striking down the approval and admonishing the GMO decision-making authorities in South Africa for failing to follow the correct procedure in terms of the biosafety law, and that the decision at various levels to approve was set aside as being null and void. However, it is important to contextualize the court case and remind ourselves that the genesis of the court case is the Water Efficient Maize for Africa project, WEMA, launched as far back as 2008. The goal of the WEMA project was to produce, using both genetic engineering and conventional hybrid breeding, drought-tolerant maize varieties for small-scale farmers in sub-Saharan Africa, purported to be a climate-smart solution. WEMA was funded to the tune of $85 million by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Howard Buffett Foundation, and USAID. Its key partners included Monsanto, now Bayer, the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, CIMMET, and the National Agricultural Research Systems in each of the WEMA countries, namely Kenya, Tanzania, South Africa, Mozambique, and Uganda. Project partners have agreed to make available their best maize germplasm lines, with Monsanto donating the drought-tolerant maize gene. Much of the germplasm from CIMMET was as a result of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation initiative called the Drought Tolerant Maize for Africa Project, which has worked to release both drought tolerant and open pollinated hybrid maize varieties in 13 African countries. For us, it was a new GE trait, which made it all the more compelling for intervention given that drought tolerance in plants is an extremely complex phenomenon. Furthermore, the WEMA project sits at the apex of efforts to completely transform African agricultural systems via its breeding program, which draws upon decades of research carried out by public research breeders for the public good. WEMA ultimately aims to shift the focus and ownership of maize breeding, seed production, and marketing almost exclusively into the domain of the private sector, and in the process ensnare small-scale farmers into the adoption of GM and hybrid maize varieties and their accompanying synthetic fertilizers and pesticides. The wheels began to turn when Monsanto made an application for commercial release of its drought-tolerant maize in South Africa way back in 2014. However, prior to this, the ACB had objected to several applications for field trials of the same variety. The advisory committee in December 2014, established in terms of South Africa's GMO Act, recommended to the Executive Council, which is the biosafety decision-making body in South Africa, that the application should be approved. And the Executive Council then duly approved the application. The ACB appealed this decision with the assistance of Attorney Adrian Pohl, and this was supported by the expert opinion of Professor Jack Heinemann, who filed his expert opinion in July 2025, which is more than 10 years ago. And his opinion was in respect to the decision to approve the GM drought-tolerant maize. Professor Heinemann, would you like to take us through the salient issues you raised in the early appeal?
Sure. I took today to remind myself of an affidavit I wrote back in 2015. The crux of the matter is that the issues that arose with this maze aren't particularly special. I mean, the trade is special, and that will have more relevance, I think, when it comes to the environmental risk assessment. And my part in the risk assessment was the molecular characterization with relevance to its use is food and feed. The maize has two proteins, two novel proteins, exogenous from genes that are exogenous to the species that we know are produced in this maize. The data that the applicant Monsanto submitted is clear about intending to express these two proteins. There may be other changes, and I didn't evaluate their evidence to see whether or not there was evidence of other changes. And I mainly just focused on the two that they acknowledge are part of either the development pathway or the necessary trait that they were of drought tolerance. So the issue is very clear in international documents. And what is surprising is how little regulators take note of the international guidance when they're conducting their own internal risk assessments. I simply used the guidance material that was developed by the ad hoc technical expert group at the time for the Cartagena Protocol on Biosafety and Codex Alimentarius. And in those frameworks, I evaluated the potential for new hazards to arise in this variety of maize. And those hazards that I identified were those two novel proteins. Now, the issue is, how do these become hazards? And what should have been an appropriate way for the regulator to look at these hazards? What transpired was the regulator received some fairly generic text that had been used really to dismiss novel proteins and other kinds of maize varieties that had been commercialized prior to this point. And that kind of text was, well, the genes that from the species, the species from which the genes were taken aren't particularly dangerous species. And we eat these kinds of, they were bacteria. We eat these bacteria all the time. We eat maize all the time. And in the forms that we eat maize, it's never been a problem when related proteins have been in our diets. This is all a very generic and assumption-based approach, which for some reason is compelling to regulators who are probably time poor and aren't excited by the idea of investigating the literature for research that may challenge such approaches, such assumption-based reasoning approaches to risk assessment. So coming at it with fresh eyes, I simply said, these are the characteristics that can make a novel protein a hazard, such as the potential for it to be a toxin or an allergen, the potential that it has an enzymatic activity that is not going to be beneficial. One of the proteins is a protein to make bacteria resistant to certain kinds of antibiotics. And the question was, does that enzymatic activity persist even in the corn, through food? And in many cases, corn in livestock is eaten in a raw form. So it's possible that this enzymatic activity is still quite viable in those cases. I also looked at what other regulators had been evaluating at the time, such as the European Food Safety Agency, and how they had dealt with these potential hazards. And I noticed that they too simply used assumption-based reasoning to dismiss the plausibility of those being hazards. And I couldn't find any underlying science in their reasoning to give me some kind of certainty that what they dismissed as hazards were scientifically dismissed, or simply in the minds of those scientists, things that were not plausible. So I went using that framework from the guidance for the Cartagena Protocol. I went step by step through the hazard identification, hazard characterization process, ending up with then what could be done. Could we make a risk assessment Or if not, could we engineer or imagine some risk mitigation processes that would then allow us to complete a risk assessment? And I found that I couldn't do either one of those. They hadn't considered in the dossier the potential for inhalation exposures. And we knew that at least one of these proteins was expressed at high levels in pollen, and pollen is borne by wind. They didn't evaluate either of the two proteins for use in food as prepared by South African or neighboring countries' food preparation techniques, didn't reflect the ethnic diversity and speciality of the area in which it was being used, and only referenced the use of maize in very different countries who also consume maize at very different levels than does South Africa or the southern part of the African continent. So there are very special aspects to releasing this maize in South Africa, none of which were customized to the South African condition, and for which the regulator didn't seem to be at all curious. And that I was pleased to see was one of the things that the court noticed, that none of these things that make it about South Africa seem to have been prioritized in the regulator's evaluation.
So thank you very much, Jack. I have to mention that what we had before us was the application for commercial release, a highly redacted version. They call it a non-CBI version, a non-confidential business information version of the risk assessment. And we had a copy of the decision made by the Executive Council and the reasons for why it had granted the approval. And all of these documents were made available to us, and Professor Heinemann had sight of these documents, and on that basis, he prepared his expert opinion. So what happened to the appeal? So this was an internally constituted appeal by the Minister of Agriculture, and the minister puts together expert scientists and lawyers that would look at all the appeal documents and make a decision. Now, Monsanto responded to our appeal by lodging its own papers. And then the appeal board, constituted by three members, deliberated on the appeal. And on the 1st of September 2016, the ACB was informed by the chairperson of the appeal board that there was no credible reason for repealing the approval and recommended that the approval be sustained. So we lost the appeal. And the GMO Act requires that the minister has the final word on the appeal, so that the decision of the appeal board goes to the minister, who can either confirm the finding of the appeal board or make a different decision. Now, previously, the minister had made a different decision concerning GM potatoes in South Africa, where the appeal board granted approval, and the minister overrode that decision. But in this case, on the 27th of October 2016, the Minister of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries upheld the appeal board's decision. But we did not take this lying down, as we thought that these decision-making bodies, the Executive Council, the appeal board, as well as the minister, merely rubber-stamped Monsanto's approval authorization, bearing in mind the issues raised and concerns raised by Professor Heinemann. And we felt that they uncritically accepted Monsanto's evidence that averred that GMOs poses no threat to human health or the environment, and ignored the contrary expert evidence of Professor Heinemann. We then approached Legal Aid South Africa to assist us in launching an application to the High Court to review the decision of the Executive Council, the Appeal Board, and the decision of the Minister. And Legal Aid agreed to assist us pro bono. Thus, the litigation in the courts began. We prepared the necessary papers to launch the application to the High Court, and we were supported by the expert opinions of Drs. Angelica Hilbeck and Dr. Eva Selina Sinji. Dr. Hilbeck, would you like to take us through your expert opinion and your experience in general with the court proceedings? And then we can have Dr. Selina Sinji to give us her inputs as to what she found when assessing the risk assessment of Monsanto, as well as the opinions of the expert opinions of Monsanto's scientists in regard to the various levels of decision making, including the findings of the appeal board when one of the members of the appeal board did not concur with the rest. So, Dr. Hilbeck, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mariam. Yeah, it'll be a pleasure. What I have to say takes it on from Professor Jack Heinemann's input, and especially the first sentence he said that the issues are not special. So we, as Professor Heinemann, also myself, we have been looking at dossiers submitted for requesting approval of GM varieties since many, many years, if not decades at that time. And so going through the documents of that Monsanto had submitted in support of its claims of safety and efficacy, the two issues I looked into, resembled a lot those that I had seen before and are always amaze me regarding their superficiality and the lack of robust science that goes into it. They have to do some field trials, so I specifically focused on the field trials. There were field trials carried out with the drought-tolerant varieties in South Africa. So I was keen to see both issues, you know, see what did they do regarding making sure this is safe for other organisms that are also living and call the maize field its home and its habitat. And I was curious to see what did they do in order to prove the efficacy so that this is a superior maize variety with regard to its drought resilience and resistance. And for both claims, I found that the scientific evidence is nearly meaningless. Specifically for the safety testing they did was the usual kind of inventories. They go through the field plots, they count what they see there in terms of aphids or so other pests or beneficial organisms we call non-target organisms that are not particularly targeted, so they should not be affected by the trait of concern. So the drought tolerance shouldn't be having any adverse effects on any other organism, neither supporting more pests nor disadvantaging any of the beneficial organisms that keep pests in check. It's a long, you know, going through the data took quite a while. Although they all had one thing in common, they were highly aggregated. The data was lumped. There was very little differentiation between different categories of insects. Specifically when it comes to the non-target organisms, they were lumped into entire insect orders or into categories of predators or in regions across various field plots or blocks. So what was lacking was a detailed description of how they obtained the data, how they made sure that it was properly controlled, and how the control was working towards the in comparison to what they found in the treated the drought tolerant fields. The statistical methods were either non-existent or very, very superficially explained. And with the statistical design, if without knowledge of how you did your experimental design, it's very difficult or impossible to understand whether the data or the claims they make are supported by the data they obtained. As I said, highly aggregated data tends to not deliver, be very sensitive to any differences due to the treatments. So they might, in other words, cover up potential effects, or the power of the statistics and the power of the design is so low that they cannot pick up differences between a treatment and a control, even if they are there. So these are typical different types of errors that occur when you do trials, experimental trials with high variabilities. And you should usually explain in detail how you control for these possibilities of errors, whether you miss an effect that is there or whether you're overly conservative and overlook effects on both sides. So I extensively wrote about that, how the field trials are not suited to support their safety claims due to lack of power, lack of differentiation, lack of explaining exactly how the design was, etc. And then coming to the efficacy data that I was very curious to see whether this actually at least is drought tolerant and supports that claim, which will be the marketed trait, which is what they will be making the additional money off. And I found that also that evidence and on efficacy was very spurious, and even admittedly by the data was very minimal. It was below 10% with all on average. In some cases, I think I remember it was around about 4 or 6% of yield protection. So it's a very strange parameter they're measuring there, because it's difficult to measure drought tolerance. And it hinges fundamentally on what kind of varieties do you choose to compare it to. So do you compare it to highly vulnerable maize varieties that cannot sustain any prolonged drought periods? Or do you compare it to varieties that have a fairly high resilience towards drought already? And both exists in maize. So there was very little information regarding what kinds of controls they've been using. And provided that they used, supposedly, they call it commercial varieties or conventional varieties out there, probably they used not the most drought-tolerant ones already in order to show a difference. But even under the most positive circumstances for the applicant, the gains they could possibly claim with very little statistical power was very low. So low that it would usually, in a commercial setting, in a non-controlled setting of a farmer, probably disappear in the noise that you have. Even when you go into a large field, you have areas where you have more or less water supply to the plants. So the plants will show more or less symptoms and signs of drought tolerance, etc. So both of them, I found for both parameters and both traits I looked into, the statistical data was very limited, if not non-existent, with very little necessary information provided that you need in order to make a robust science-based claim, and in essence, rubber stamped. So I was surprised. Oh, no, I'm not surprised. Let's put it this way, because we found with similar limited data sets submitted even to the European regulator, we found that even the European regulators were always accepting basically at face value what the applicant would tell them. And if you looked at the data set and the robustness of the claims and the statistical details you needed to have, you usually had to find that none of that data would support these safety claims or efficacy claims. Again, also no uncertainties were ever acknowledged. and no scientific, what would be necessary to say where is the limits of my designs, to what degree can I make any robust claims, and where is the limit, where is the end of it, and where do uncertainties begin, which are quintessential when you want to apply the precautionary principle.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Hilbeck. Dr. Inasinghe, would you like to take us through your expert opinion that you filed in support of our appeal, our review?
Thank you, Miriam. So I think I just wanted to touch on a couple of points that we picked up on in my aspect of the work, which was to assess their experts' analysis of JAC's independent risk assessment, and also to look at the confidential business information. So some of the data that we wouldn't normally get to see published in the risk assessments that are available. So I was expecting when we would get the new data that there would be a lot for us to analyze, a new data to critique. But I think what was quite striking from this work was the lack of data from which the regulatory decisions were built upon. Also the overclaiming that was made on this very little data to critique JAC's risk assessment that went into the previous rounds of appeal. So for us, when we looked through the analysis of the experts' critique of JAC, what was quite clear there was a lack of referral lack of referral to the Cartagena Protocol and the international obligations under the precautionary approach. So in the expert opinion, it starts off with trying to claim that this GM crop has received regulatory approvals across the world, and it's in line with regulatory guidelines such as the Codex, but there is a very consistent lack of referral to the Cartagena Protocol and the obligations within that, which include adhering to a precautionary approach. And that means that the burden of proof is on proving safety rather than harm. And you can see why there was a lack of referral to that in the documents, because when you go through the analysis and you go through the data, the burden of proof was placed on, for example, on JAC to prove the plausible hazards and risks that he identified, rather than on the developer to prove the safety of their products. And I think what was striking was, for me, when looking through the data, was how much there was a level of overclaiming for this safety and a claim of certainty around this safety. But then when you look at the data, what we found was a very clear difference between what was being said and the data that was presented. So for example, there was for toxicity data, there were claims that a mouse study had been performed, and also there was reference to a rat study. But when we got the confidential business information to confirm that safety had been improved, this data was still lacking. So we don't know if that data is available to their experts or to the court, but none of this was furnished to us to substantiate any claims of safety with regard to toxicity data. Another aspect that was very interesting was the allergenicity data, where you were supposed to provide data to show that the introduced products do not cause allergenicity or alter the plant to cause allergenicity in some form. And again, here, certainty was claimed regarding the data that there's no allergenicity risks. The proteins that are produced in the plant are digested in the digestive system. They perform sort of surrogate studies to look at that. Does it digest in stomach juices? And they claim because there's no protein left, it gets digested. There's no risk of exposure and therefore no allergenicity risk. But when we got the data, we could see that claim was also not indeed correct. There were still proteins that were not being fully digested. So the claims were clearly not matching with the data, that very little data that they had to begin with. It wasn't that there was more data to substantiate their argument. It was just one thing was being said and one thing was being presented in the data, and they didn't align. So I think it was very clear for us where we could highlight where they had not followed the protocol and were attempting to put the burden of proof onto ACB's experts, and that is in contradiction to the protocol, and also that they didn't have their own data to back up their own claims. And that was, I think, quite clear throughout the process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ava. Ava mentioned that she had sight of confidential business information components of the risk assessment. We have to remember that Monsanto made an application to bar us from access to its confidential business information components of the risk assessment as well as the expert testimony. And the application was heard before Judge Tolmay. We opposed the application, and she found in our favor. She ruled that our experts are allowed to have access to that information for the purposes of the litigation and to ensure access to justice, as well as the ACB, although we had access to this information under surveillance. Our experts were given the information under condition that we all sign papers that we would not disclose the information shared with us. So I think that that's important for us to note. It's very, very it's unheard of that we would have access to confidential business information components of the risk assessment in particular. This is always redacted. So I think it's important to note that we lost the case at the High Court in June 2023, when the same judge, Tolmay, rejected the ACB's concerns that the Executive Council failed to conduct a rigorous scientific assessment, and it failed to evaluate and engage critically with the paucity of information furnished by Monsanto, as outlined by all three of our experts, particularly about unsubstantiated claims of drought tolerance, to satisfy itself that the general release of the drought-tolerant maize ought to have been approved. Further, the judge also rejected ACB's arguments regarding procedural fairness in the process, claiming that it was fair, and it refused to refer the matter back to the Executive Council to reconsider its decision and potentially decide to ask for an environmental impact assessment and a socioeconomic assessment report. From there, a proper determination of risk posed by the GM maize in question could have been made to safeguard the constitutional right to an environment that is not detrimental to health and well-being as required by our constitution. These calls from the ACB were based on the precautionary principle, which states that for activities that may significantly affect the environment, decision makers must apply a risk-averse and cautious approach that considers the limits of current knowledge about the consequences of decisions and actions. It appears that the court accepted the fallacious argument of Monsanto that it was up to the ACB to prove that the GM maize in question does not pose a significant threat to the environment and human health, an approach that would render the precautionary approach meaningless, as Dr. Sirina Sinji already alluded to. However, even though this was drawn to the court's attention, it appears that it favored Monsanto's approach. Still, the ACB did not leave the matter there. We applied for leave to appeal to Judge Tolmay, which he granted, and we took the matter to the Supreme Court of Appeal. After 9 long years of arduous litigation, a full bench consisting of 5 judges of the Supreme Court of Appeal, sitting in Bloemfontein on the 22nd of October 2024, set aside several layers of decision-making regarding approval of the application by Monsanto now Bayer for commercial release of its drought-tolerant maize. Significantly, the Supreme Court of Appeal also set aside the judgment of Judge Tolmay. The ACB has consistently maintained the Executive Council merely rubber stamps GMO applications, as it did in this case, and that it uncritically accepts the paucity of evidence that GMOs pose no threat to human health or the environment, and it ignores the contrary expert evidence tenders by groups like the ACB, as we have done in this case. Unanimously, the Supreme Court of Appeal found that there was an abject failure by the Executive Council to comply with the mandatory prescript contained in Section 5.1a of the GMO Act to determine whether Monsanto was required to submit an environmental impact assessment as required by the National Environmental Management Act. The acronym for that is NEMA. The Supreme Court of Appeal in its judgment noted that it was a relatively straightforward matter for the state to have adduced evidence that a determination was made one way or the other, but it had failed to do so. The finding was extremely significant because it brings into sharp relief the rubber-stamping nature of decision-making in South Africa concerning GMOs, something we have witnessed and resisted over the past 21 years, especially the failure to make a proper determination of the risks posed by GMOs to safeguard the constitutional right to an environment that is not detrimental to our health and well-being. The judgment of the Supreme Court of Appeal has vindicated us and made these long years of struggle very worthwhile. This is the first judicial decision concerning GMO decision-making in South Africa, and as such is precedent-setting, particularly since it sets aside three layers of decision-making by the Executive Council, the Appeal Board, and the Minister. Additionally, it also sets aside the High Court judgment of Judge Tolmay. The ACB has welcomed the findings of the Supreme Court of Appeal regarding the applicability of the precautionary principle. Judge Tolmay's findings came under the Supreme Court of Appeal scrutiny, as the learned judges of the Supreme Court of Appeal viewed the precautionary principle as being central to the matter before it. The saga continued. The Minister of Agriculture could not leave the matter. It applied in November 2024 for leave to appeal to the Constitutional Court to overturn the decision of the Supreme Court of Appeal. The ACB duly opposed the application. On November 4th, 2025, the Constitutional Court, with 11 judges presiding, dismissed the application of the Minister of Agriculture for leave to appeal with costs. The court stated that the application bore no reasonable prospects of success. This means the original Supreme Court judgment of October 2024 in ACB's favor against Monsanto, now Bayer, and the state remains in effect. The Supreme Court's ruling had set aside the commercial approval of the drought-tolerant maize due to procedural failures. The application for commercial release must now be sent back to the Executive Council GMO Act for proper reconsideration in accordance with the South African law, bearing in mind the Supreme Court of Appeal's judgment as well as that of the Constitutional Court. We say that this is precedent setting, as the decisions of both the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court ensures that South African laws regarding environmental impact assessments and the precautionary principle are here due before the release of GMOs. That brings to an end the long saga. In the future, the government will have to take into account the findings of the Supreme Court of Appeal and will have to consider very carefully whether environmental impact assessments are required and adhere to the precautionary principle. We will be watching the South African government very closely. At the moment, it has several applications before it that we objected to, including GM wheat for field trials, also consisting of HB4 drought tolerant trait, as well as a new application for field trials of canola. So this brings to an end our podcast, and may I ask our experts, Jack, Angelica, and Ava, if they would like to have some closing remarks. Jack?
Well, thank you for that. I just want to congratulate ACB on its tenacity. This is a long, long road, and your ability to stick with it and in a principled fashion is what really won the day. And I've noticed that probably in the last 4 or 5 years, there have been a number of important court decisions on this topic in different countries, all of them brought forward by civil society against a collective response by the industry and the state. And in each of those cases, what has happened is the court has made it possible for the scientific community, who is not connected with the industry, and for civil society to have their views heard objectively, openly, and in a way in which they can't simply be dismissed by prerogative of those who have power. And in each of those cases, I think the court has really demonstrated that when there's a fair playing field and the issues can be discussed in this way, the outcome is not the outcome that we have come to know for the last 20, 30 years. So I think you should be congratulated for doing it, but also everyone should recognize the sacrifices that ACB would have made financially, as well as emotionally, intellectually, over that period of time in order to have this outcome. So thanks. And thanks for having me involved.
Thank you very much, Jack. Well, you started the ball rolling and you were very gracious and you assisted us way back then. It's more than 10 years ago. And so for that, we are very grateful. Dr. Hilbeck.
Thank you very much. I would like to echo what Professor Heinemann said before. I was there also during the hearing, the court hearing of the Supreme Court of Appeals. And I must say, I was deeply impressed by the diligence and the obvious informedness of the judges, all five of them. They had read the hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of documents. They knew the statements. They knew what was written in it, which echoes exactly what Jack just said, that once you put that level of evidence that comes along with these dossiers submitted to the regulator for approval of their products, once you put a independent mind to it that is not already, you know, in one bulk court or another, and somebody looks at the evidence that is actually put in front of our regulators, there is only one conclusion, that it is too little and too late, basically, to submit and support the overreaching claims of both safety, lack of risk, and of efficacy. And I think what this shows also, that the whole court case and the action of Bayer, Monsanto, and the state is they grew so used to that this is the gold standard level of what you have to submit to a state and a regulator to get your approval, to get away with your claims, that they were literally shocked to see that this didn't fly in South Africa at the highest level. And for me, as a European, working with European agency, where the same level of very limited data, to put it very politely, is submitted to. And also we're involved in court cases at our traditional systems here in Europe or at state level. It was impressive to see how the arguments and the facts that Monsanto and the state were confronted with in their dossiers, asking questions like, how did your own assessment of a small risk on page X turn into no risk a few hundred pages down in your arguments without providing the necessary data and evidence to support that claim that a small risk became a no risk? I had only, when I sat there and listened to the judges and the questioning of everyone, including the lawyers in support of ACB, to the core, to the bone marrow, as we say, I was really impressed. And I knew these were people who wanted to know the truth, basically, and wanted to understand how does this work. And they were also dismayed that the custom that we have been facing is that the state and the industry come forward as a collective. And Mariam, you correct me, but if I remember correctly, one of the judges challenged the state representative and said that, why would this collective be? Why would you be in a collective with the private entity, with the applicant, instead of being with us, with the state, or with a judicial system, or being an independent standalone voice or agency, basically? And they were numbed. They didn't know what to say. You know, they had never been confronted in that way with that obvious fact of being in a collective with the industry, the very subject they should independently and critically evaluate, not just independently. I would like to emphasize that they have to critically question the data, the evidence that is put in front of them, because the industry legitimately has an interest that is different from the regulator and the people. And they're entitled to submit all kinds of data, but they must, and we, the people, must rely that the regulator is capable and willing to critically and independently evaluate that data and make sure whether it complies with the law or not. And it became quite obvious that this wasn't the case. And I would challenge and say that is also the accustomed norm in Europe and certainly in also in other countries of the world. And I think South Africa is a shining example now where a judicial system takes the precautionary principle and its underlying requirements to operate under precaution really, really serious. And when you take it serious, you ask different questions and you come to different conclusions. So it was a very, very satisfying experience for myself to sit in the rooms and be a firsthand witness of these procedures. And I was deeply impressed with the system in South Africa and would like to thank that you allowed me that privilege of being a witness to these proceedings.
Thank you, Angelica. Yes, thank you for reminding me. There was a moment during the proceedings in Bloemfontein when one of the judges asked the advocate representing the state, why are you in the same box as Monsanto against
the collective? Yeah.
In this collective against a public interest organization, a small little organization acting in the public interest. Why do we find ourselves in this position? But it didn't faze them, because when we won the case, it was the minister who applied to the Constitutional Court for leave to appeal because they couldn't live down the decision. So I want to also say, before giving Eva a chance to respond, is that the case had a profound impact on on the legislation, because there is a draft biodiversity bill which has a chapter dealing with GMOs, and it now requires all applications concerning GMOs release into the environment to be sent to the Minister of Environment, and for him or her to make a decision whether an environmental authorization as well as an environmental impact assessment is required. So they put in another layer of an attempt at good governance and to have more coherency between the Department of Agriculture and Environment. So we already see a shift in the legislation, although it's dropped. But so it has had already some major impacts. Ava, the last word from you.
I think I would, Miriam, like to echo Angelica and Jack in congratulating you for this. I think this is a momentous victory that is going to inspire me for many years. And I think it just to echo again what they're saying, I think there's something that I always struggle with when we're doing this work is this denigration of the public versus the experts and their science. They have the science on their side, they have the evidence, and we, for asking questions, we don't understand. We don't understand the science, or it's based on ideology or values that somehow are not in line with science and progress and so on. But you, Miriam, had the strength to know, to stand up to this kind of pressure and to keep asking the questions, because what we did was ask, where is the science, where is the data? We kept asking, we got confidential business information, still there's a lack of data. And I think that it clearly shows that I don't know how to put it clearly, but we, I think you had the strength to withstand this constant pressure for us to not have the science on our side. And once you provided the evidence, we got it through the court case, after all of these years, all these questions that we had, I felt were validated. The overclaims were there, the lack of certainty was there, and finally we had a fair audience to hear those. And it really, I think, is a big lesson for us going forward when we face these challenges over and over again, to stand with our questions, stand with our concerns, and ask for the burden of proof we place on developers to show that they are not risking us, they're not risking the public, they're not risking sovereignty going forward. So thank you, Miriam, for all of this work that you've done.
Well, I have to say that we can't take the praise alone. We would not have been able to do what we did over the long years had we not been supported by all of you. We could not do this without independent experts who took the time and trouble to read all the documents and provide independent expert opinions to support the case. Impossible. We would not have been able to do it, because we're dealing with molecular biology, we're dealing with entomology, we're dealing with so many aspects around food safety, environmental safety. And this is not within the realm of NGOs who are working in the environmental justice field. We would have to rely on experts. So without the three of you, we would not have been able to do it. Finally, litigation is a game for kings. We would not have been able to afford this litigation had we not been supported by Legal Aid. They did a phenomenal job. The Board of Legal Aid stood by us through all these years. Even when we lost the case at the High Court, they were determined to appeal. And even when there was a successful outcome and the minister dragged us to the Constitutional Court, they still found the resources to pay for two counsel, a senior counsel, a junior counsel. And so we are very, very grateful to Legal Aid and to the advocates who represented us, to all of you, to the staff and our team at the ACB for also continuing to support us and to keep the morale high, because we encountered a lot of setbacks along the way. And I think that we must look at this case as not just being about the drought-tolerant maize, but about putting the GMO decision-making on trial, as well as putting the paucity of data and the shoddy nature of risk assessments conducted by applicants like Monsanto, which is very typical of applications being brought before decision-making, not only in South Africa concerning GMOs, but across the world, because it's all copy-paste. They use the same application for risk assessment all over the world. And so this is a good illustration of that exposure that took place during the course of this court case. And it's typical of what's happening all across the world. And so I think for that, we should also be thankful that we were able to put this in the public domain. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.